We take God and all the holy angels to witness this day, that we warn all men in the name of Jesus Christ to come on us no more forever. For from this hour we will bear it no more. Our rights shall no more be trampled on with impunity. The man or the set of men who attempts it does it at the expense of their lives. And that mob that comes on us to disturb us, it shall be between us and them a war of extermination, for we will follow them till the last drop of their blood is spilled, or else they will have to exterminate us. For we will carry the seed of war to their own houses and their own families, and one party or the other shall be utterly destroyed. Remember it then, all men. Sidney Rigdon, July 4th, 1838.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Ever had one of those days where you're in the middle of something crappy only to end up in something worse? Come on, you know what I'm talking about. You're cleaning the bathroom when one of your kids pokes their head through the door and tells you that the littlest one has not just puked everywhere but all over the new carpet. Ever had that happen? Great. Then you're going to be in the perfect mindset for today. I want you to rewind your memories back to what seems like a decade ago, to this episode on the end of the Kirtland Safety Society. You will remember that by the end of 1837, Kirtland is basically imploded. What's wild is that it was not that long after the dedication of the temple in 1836 and the high water spiritual marks of angels and visions and all of that. Oh, the mighty Morms, how they have fallen.
The good ladies and dudes at the Joseph Smith Papers Project were nice enough to summarize this growing legal smelliness going on in Kirtland. They note that Joseph Smith was involved in no less than 22 different lawsuits during the second half of 1837. 22! I got audited once last year, and it sucked. So, 22 lawsuits? No thank you. Not interested in that level of nonsense. Joseph and company had gone to some, let's say, drastic measures. They had mortgaged Grandmother Temple there in Kirtland to try and fix their very large level of debts, for example. In 1837, in September, they tried to renegotiate all of their accounts with Eastern creditors. And I know, it sounds like a crappy late-night commercial. Having a hard time paying for all that hardtack and molasses candy? Call now, I mean right now, using a homemade envelope to Unpaved Roads and Cholera Debt Solutions.
Things didn't get any better. That's kind of why our last episode, recorded in Kirtland, even exists. The financial situation deteriorated and people got pissed and started talking back. Several dozen people were excommunicated and the mood got even uglier. These weren't just anybody's. Martin Harris gets the boot, as well as Luke Johnson and John Boynton. For those keeping score at home, that would be the last remaining of the three witnesses to the Book of Mormon and two apostles. No small thing. Remember how fascinated people were when a 70 got excommunicated just a few years ago? Well, this was big news. Big, big news. Joseph Smith started feeling the heat, and the result was a revelation. Three revelations, actually.
The first one of these three would be very odd if we didn't know the context. Joseph Smith and company were gathered at the Peter French farm in Kirtland and were kind of wondering out loud about the process for bringing the president of the church before a church court. Now, why in the world are they wondering about this? Well, you see, all these dudes that had been excommunicated were not just about to take their medicine. They formed their own church, and they were actively trying to have Joseph Smith removed because they saw him as a fallen prophet now. And this revelation was pretty slick. The answer they got was that one single high council couldn't make church-wide decisions. In other words, the high council there in Kirtland couldn't excommunicate Joseph Smith. It had to be the council in Zion, i.e. Missouri, i.e. located 800 miles away from the dissenters. My personal favorite section of this revelation makes it clear that only three members in good standing could bring charges against Joseph Smith. That's convenient. Revelation number two for the day continued on this theme. They asked the question, quote, "Can any branch of the Church of Latter-day Saints be considered a stake of Zion until they have acknowledged the authority of the First Presidency by a vote of said church? Thus saith the Lord, verily I say unto you, nay." Nice try, dissenters. No stake for you.
Now for the last in the Revelation trilogy, let's call it the Get Out of Dodge Revelation. It starts, quote, "Thus saith the Lord, let the presidency of my church take their families as soon as it is practicable and move on to the west as fast as the way is made plain," end quote. So the Lord is basically telling them that the Kirtland chapter is now over. Oh, and about those dissenters, quote, "Woe unto those who have become your enemies, who have professed my name, saith the Lord, for their judgment lingereth not, and their damnation slumbereth not." Good, because nobody likes sleepy damnation, am I right? In case you were curious whether the attitude towards dissenters would be a constant theme today, rest easy, because it absolutely will be. Joseph and Sidney Rigdon were very obedient, leaving Kirtland the same day. Their families came a few days later, but the main group of Mormons there wouldn't leave until later in the year. The departure of Joseph Smith did not ease the tensions. The printing office was burned a few days after they left. Nice exit. Not the most heroic optics of Joseph Smith's life.
Fast forward a couple months now, March 1838, and Joseph Smith is more or less settled in Missouri, and this ends that unwieldy two-headquarters situation of the past 7 years. Unwieldy, you say? Definitely. Here's the story. The presidency down in Missouri had been David and John Whitmer along with W.W. Phelps, and all three of them were under suspicion of some shadiness related to land deals, mostly. There were also allegations that they didn't keep the word of wisdom, which in 1838 just sounds really anachronistic, right? They must have been seriously boozing it up to be getting called out for it. And remember, anything regarding either of these concerns or anything else has to come back to Kirtland via letter in a journey of a couple weeks at least. And in a trip they had taken to Missouri right before hightailing it out of Kirtland, the Missouri presidency had confessed their faults and promised to do better, but it really was an uneasy resolution at the end of the day. In fact, just as Joseph Smith is traveling to Far West, Thomas Marsh, the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, heads up a push to try and oust the entire presidency there. They were removed from their positions first, and then John Whitmer and W.W. Phelps were excommunicated a month later. So now Marsh, all fat and giggly from all those extra milk strippings, pausing here until the laughter subsides, he's put in as the new interim president, and fellow apostles David Patton and Brigham Young are put in as assistant presidents.
The shakeup wasn't over. In April of 1838, David Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery were also excommunicated. Hiram Page also leaves around this time, meaning the entire extended Whitmer family, remember Cowdery and Page had both married Whitmers, had been shown the exit. Not only did this mean that a whole pile of talented and integral figures had been severed, but it also was a symbolic development. The early days of a more egalitarian, hippie Mormonism where everyone could help steer the boat were gone. Joseph Smith's position as the guy was completely solidified. And quick tangent here, when Oliver Cowdery was thrown out, a whole laundry list of charges against him were presented. Some were pretty lame, like treating the church with contempt by not attending meetings. Ooh, not going to gospel doctrine, Oliver, you rebel. But some of the others were explosive charges. Charge number two claimed that Oliver was, quote, seeking to destroy the character of President Joseph Smith by falsely insinuating that he was guilty of adultery. That's some Jerry Falwell level stuff right there. Cowdery knew something about Joseph Smith's whatever it was with Fanny Alger and was yelling about it. Another charge, charge number four, was also pretty heavy. Quote, virtually denying the faith by declaring that he would not be governed by any ecclesiastical authority, nor revelation, whatever in his temporal affairs. Joseph Smith had always erased the line between spiritual and temporal. I mean, one of his revelations explicitly does that. But that had become increasingly problematic. The combination of Kirtland Safety Society and land sales in Missouri had proved to be very toxic for Mormon society.
For about 5 minutes, roughly, it seemed like maybe Missouri was actually going to work out. With all of those pesky apostate faces out of the way, Joseph Smith could try again to create Zion. They tried earlier, obviously, in Missouri. Hadn't gone well. Get a newspaper going again. Most importantly, build a temple. And Missouri had been ambiguous all along. It was Zion, the land of milk and honey, the center place. But Joseph Smith didn't even live there. Yeah, he visited now and again, but his real home was in Kirtland. The temple? Also in Kirtland. Now? Zion time. Buckle up. Sure, it's not Independence, it's not the real center place, but it was at least center adjacent. Good enough. Far west wasn't sufficient, though. As everyone starts trickling in from Kirtland, Joseph and associates kind of go exploring in the surroundings, which is where we get the best place name in all of Mormon history. A valley in next-door Davis County is identified as Adam Ondi Amen. Over time, lazy people shortened it to Diamond. That will be the only time we will use that word, however. If you're thinking the name sounds very Kirtland, Egyptian papers, Book of Abraham-y, yep, totally. Joseph Smith, always up for an adventure, takes a posse with him and they explore the valley, which is pretty awesome if you ever get a chance to visit there. Do it. Over time, Joseph would explain that this is where Eve and Adam come after getting booted out of the Garden of Eden. Now remember, Joseph Smith has reoriented all of human history to the precise place they are standing. Oh, and there's an old Nephite-ish altar there too. Cool. Even more impressive, it was, quote, the place where Adam shall come to visit his people, or the Ancient of Days shall sit, as spoken of by Daniel the prophet.
The 5 minutes of peace were ticking away. This expansion around Far West started raising the neighbors' eyebrows, to say the least. That old phrase, all publicity is good publicity, is 1,000%. Not applicable to Mormons. If they had crappy local TV news at that point, I guarantee there would have been lots of ominous commercials for a special investigative story. Who are all these dudes moving into your neighborhood saying that God has given the land to them? Tune in Monday night for Go Away, You Filthy Mormonites. However, the bigger problem actually came from within. All the angriness and final days of Kirtland had just sort of moved west with Joseph Smith. Dissenters were getting louder and louder, and in June, Sidney Rigdon went full Boyd Packer on the situation. We don't have a full report of what he said, but one particular spicy statement gave it the name his Salt Sermon, which I'm sure you've heard of. Salt Sermon Rigdon apparently referred to the section of the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says it all, says if the salt has, quote, lost its savor, it should be cast out and trodden underfoot. Not too much reading between the lines was needed. Dissenters could peace out on their way, or maybe some friendly encouragement would be necessary.
Just in case the salt metaphor was lost on the audience, a petition was created that was directed toward these filthy, dirty apostates. Dudes like Oliver Cowdery, the Whitmers, also excommunicated Apostle Lyman Johnson, etc. It starts, quote, greeting, which was really the only friendly word in the whole thing. The TLDR here, we've put up with your crap long enough. No mas. Surprisingly, the letter, which does survive, isn't scorched around the edges because it breathed some serious fire. Quote, there are no threats from you, no fear of losing our lives by you, or anything you can say or do will restrain us, for out of the county you shall go. Close quote. They were given 3 days to get out, or they were warned, quote, we will use the means in our power to cause you to depart, for go you shall. Kind of a Dr. Seuss ending there. I mean, It was a very violent tone. Quote, "Vengeance sleeps not, neither does it slumber, and unless you heed us this time and attend to our request, it will overtake you at an hour where you do not expect it and at a day where you do not look for it." Yikes. The first signatory to the seven-page rant, a guy named Samson Avard, which is both A, a great name, and B, a fake name I used to have mail delivered once. Hopefully, with such an awesome name, he'll play a role in what's coming, right?
Well, now it's time for one of the most infamous, notorious groups in Mormon history, the Society of the Daughter of Zion. Okay, I know it doesn't sound that badass, and if you're thinking, what the hell, that's not a very cool name, or I've never heard of that, yes and yes. In this climate of very Desnaddish rhetoric, a group comes together first called the Society of the Daughter of Zion. And it's going to be a lot more badass than it sounds. A good rule of thumb is, if a name or phrase sounds weird, there's an excellent chance it's probably taken, yanked from the pages of the Bible, probably buried in the Old Testament. It seems like this group of Daughters of Zion were actually a bunch of dudes who were thinking of Micah when they started their club for grown-ass men. One verse says, quote, "Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make thine horn iron, and I will make thy hoofs brass, and thou shalt beat in pieces many people, and I will consecrate their gain unto the Lord, and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth," end quote. No club with a crappy name can survive, so they were kind of commonly known as Danites, which really isn't that much cooler, but whatever. Samson Avard was the recognized leader. Joseph Smith was certainly involved some and seems to have been totally cool with them. Oh yeah, and also his occasional loose cannon counselor Sidney Rigdon was also involved.
A month after the SALT sermon, Rigdon was ready to expand his horizons. Having first gone after dissenters, it was now time to piss off the non-Mormons. The setting this time was Independence Day, July 4th, 1838 in Far West Missouri. Rigdon delivers a truly explosive oration. He started with an innocuous enough opening. Mormons honored their Revolutionary War predecessors. Good, good. The American government is, quote, "known throughout the civilized world as the standard of freedom, civil, religious, and political." Yeah, clap, clap, clap. Quote, "and celebrating this, the anniversary of our independence, all party distinctions should be forgotten. All religious differences should be laid aside." Hear, hear, Elder Rigdon. Quote, "In times of peace, it ought to be our aim and our object to strengthen the bonds of the Union by cultivating peace and goodwill among ourselves." Thumbs up, sir. Quote, "and in times of war, to meet our foes sword in hand and defend our rights at the expense of life." Wait, what? Quote, "we take God and the holy angels to witness this day that we warn all men in the name of Jesus Christ to come on us no more forever. For from this hour we will bear it no more. Our rights shall no more be trampled on with impunity. The man or the set of men who attempts it does it at the expense of their lives. And that mob that comes on us to disturb us, it shall be between us and them a war of extermination. For we will follow them till the last drop of their blood is spilled, or else they will have to exterminate us. For we will carry the seat of war to their own houses and their own families, and one party or the other shall be utterly destroyed." Oh, crap. Sydney's gone off the rails again.
Okay, so you might think, okay, it's just crazy old Rigdon again. He was just speaking and got caught up in the moment. Yeah, no. All these statements come from a pamphlet with his remarks. A spur-of-the-moment bad idea is one thing, but publishing your bad ideas is next level. Sending copies of your published bad ideas to the newspapers? Well, that's just shooting yourself in both feet. The tagline from a speech that they picked for the front cover? This is great. "Better far sleep with the dead than be oppressed among the living." Geez, why was anyone afraid of the Mormons? Amazingly, this doesn't seem to have started anything yet. What really got the pot boiling was an election day fight a month later at a town called Gallatin. Mormons voting in block had already been a problem, and this was no exception. The story goes that Mormons tried to cast their ballots and the locals shut them down. My guess is that there was a little more to it on the Mormon side. John Butler tells of having the spirit come over him and then cracking a few skulls. I love it when God inspires you to do so. It turned into a pretty ugly, frontiersy melee, almost certainly with a little moonshine fueling the craziness.
Now, as stories like these tend to do, it got exaggerated very quickly. Word gets back to headquarters that a few Mormons were killed in the skirmish. It was actually complete fiction, but it set in motion the whole series of events that ends with Mormons being forced to leave the state.
Hi, I'm historian Christopher C. Smith. In August and November 1838, Mormons and their Gentile Missourian neighbors clashed in the Mormon War of 1838. At issue in this war were not only religious differences, but also basic civil liberties. Missourians had expelled the block-voting Mormons from county after county, and the Mormons in turn had expelled dissenters and Gentiles from their own communities. Both sides had suffered violence and had lost land and property. Brewing anger erupted in an election day brawl in early August that escalated to full-scale war by mid-October. On October 20, in the Mormon capital of Far West, Missouri, First Counselor to the First Presidency, Sidney Rigdon, called a mass meeting at the schoolhouse. Joseph Smith was away at the time, coordinating raids to loot and burn Gentile stores and houses in neighboring Davies County. Most of the attendees at this October 20th meeting were members of an infamous Mormon paramilitary organization known as the Danites, after the biblical warrior tribe of Dan. Brigadier General Samson Avard, second in command and First Presidency spokesman to the Danite band, assisted Rigdon in presiding over this meeting. The purpose of the October 20th meeting was to organize the defense of Far West. Mormons expected an imminent invasion by Missourian vigilante groups and state militia. At this meeting, Rigdon and Avard created several paramilitary companies, including a spy company under Danite Captain Amasa Lyman, and a messenger company under Postmaster W.W. Phelps. Phelps was not a Danite, but he attended this well-guarded meeting at Rigdon's special invitation. Rigdon was an extremist, and his rhetoric had grown more and more violent throughout the Mormons' confrontation with their neighbors. This October 20th meeting brought out his worst impulses. He assigned Captain Lyman's spy company not only to monitor enemy activity, but also to clandestinely commit acts of arson against the Missourians in retaliation for the burning of Mormon homes. If necessary, the company should burn down the cities of Richmond, Liberty, and Buncombe, the county seats that had dispatched militias to fight the Mormons. Then someone made an even more disturbing suggestion, that if arson didn't work to deter the Missourians, the spy company could poison the Missourians' food supply. John Coral, who did not attend the meeting, heard this paraphrase from someone who was present. Quote, "They might scatter poison, pestilence, and disease among the inhabitants, and make them think it was judgment sent from God." Unquote. Apostle Thomas B. Marsh claimed that it was Avard who made this suggestion. But Marsh also got his information secondhand, just like Coral. Burr Riggs, who was present and heard the use of poison discussed, missed part of the conversation and couldn't identify who had brought it up. W.W. Phelps, who fortunately paid better attention than Riggs, said that it was Rigdon who made the suggestion to poison the Missourians. It's unclear whether Joseph Smith ever heard about this poisoning proposal. George M. Hinkle accused him in a letter dated June 12, 1842, "I also know about the arsenic you directed to be thrown in the wells in Missouri." But Hinkle didn't attend the October 1838 meeting, and he made no reference to poisoning when he testified about the war before a court in Richmond that November. Probably he learned about the poisoning proposal from the testimony of other witnesses at the November hearing. Hinkle did testify at the hearing that Smith had told him about the plan for retaliatory arson, so Smith knew and approved of at least some of the plans from the October 20th meeting. But the only surviving evidence to indicate Smith's opinion of the poisoning proposal comes from John Coral, who, quote, "accused Smith and Rigdon of it, but they both denied it promptly," The Saints, of course, never actually conducted any poison attacks against the Missourians. This was an offhand suggestion, made in a moment of enthusiasm, probably by Sidney Rigdon. The Saints made many militant remarks during the Mormon War, most of which they never acted upon. The fact that the suggestion was even made, however, is a chilling reminder that the potential for great evil lies within all of us and is no respecter of religion or creed.
Okay, alright. Time out on the court for just a minute here. Telling Mormon history in a middle-of-the-road, fair manner, it's difficult. And the two of us certainly aren't perfect, but we are aiming for this. It's hard. The persecution mentality burns deeply in the Mormon psyche, and always lurks in the background when trying to narrate history. Now, on the other hand, that pendulum can swing back too far the other way. Lately, it seems like it's almost fashionable to throw out things like, the Mormons were responsible for everything that happened in Missouri. I can't swear we're going to get it just right. We're going to get that pendulum nice and perpendicular to the ground, but we will try, I promise. Back to your regularly scheduled programming.
After the election fight, Joseph Smith rode at the head of the group still hopped up on Sidney Rigdon's Independence Day speech. They went to the house of Adam Black, a local judge, to get some assurance that they would be protected. A classic game of he said was the result. According to Mormon reports, Black agreed with them and said he would make sure they were taken care of. Black, on the other hand, claimed the Mormons threatened him at his house. Given how tough the Mormons have been talking over the last couple months, it seems like Black was probably not making this up. The Joseph Smith Papers folks make a good point. A few years earlier, Mormons were thrown out of the Jackson County area because they were the minority. At this point, however, Mormon numbers were steadily going up and the locals were getting nervous. Here's the thing, every time Mormons start to gather in one area in the 19th century, it causes problems, no exceptions.
The American experiment democracy was never a smooth ride. In more frontiersy areas, things could really get kind of spotty. The beginnings of nativism, which results in nonsense like the Know-Nothing movement later, right? Only native-born Americans. Not those kind of native-born Americans, like the European guys that moved here, and then their descendants are native-born Americans. Yeah, it's pretty hypocritical. All the beginnings of this is there during the 1830s. And Mormon rights were not always protected. I think we just have to agree on that one. Flip side, and this is the one where Mormons have a hard time, their ancestors were pretty scary. They're talking about God giving them the land, they challenge Christianity, they have new scripture, and they have the potential to control local politics. Mormons, for some reason, have always struggled to understand why the entire rest of the world can't just see the rightness of their cause. For the rest of Joseph Smith's life, off and on, he and associates will, I think really sincerely, look around and wonder why no one sees their point. The end of Missouri is probably the apex of this mindset. Mormons cannot understand why politicians, both at the local and state level, and later the national level, don't recognize that their rights are being trampled and come to their rescue. In conclusion, Missouri, like Libya, is a land of contrast.
At the center of it is Joseph Smith, obviously, but also Lyman White. White was a Danite officer and Joseph Smith's right-hand man in a lot of ways during this period. There's a coordinated attempt to arrest both of the Mormon leaders. So here's another point where we have to sift through conflicting narratives. Mormons see this whole thing as a ruse to attack them. From the perspective of the locals, Joseph Smith is trying to overtake the county and refuse to submit to the law. So here's where the tension really gets ramped up. The next couple of months are a series of raids and vigilante attacks. Again, it's hard to get a clear picture of how things went down, but it seems like initially the locals were on the offensive. Over time, however, Mormons get the upper hand and most locals basically leave the county.
The conflict spread anywhere Mormons have settled in the area. It starts to take on the character of a small-scale war with loosely organized militia units, both locals and the Mormons. Things got real, as you might imagine. Men on both sides are killed. the persecution complex that will haunt Mormons up until exactly today is born in these months. This is where Apostle David Patton is killed in a skirmish at Crooked River. A few days later, the most significant episode takes place at a small settlement founded by non-Mormon but friendly Jacob Hahn. 10 Mormons, including several boys, are killed in a surprise attack. In the Mormon lore, this event almost happens in a vacuum. These Mormons, peacefully living at Hahn's Mill, are killed by these dirty, bloodthirsty Missourians for no reason. And this story is actually very personal to me. My ancestor, Thomas McBride, is the old Revolutionary War veteran who gets hacked to death by the corn cutter. Continuing the theme of this episode, even his story doesn't get told right. He was born during the Revolutionary War, and at 62 he was old, but not like this doddering old guy about to fall over. And what happened there was terrible. There's no way around that. But it was also part of a series of events. It seems like this attack at Hahn's Mill was retaliation for Mormon raids earlier in the month. The point here is this situation really does look like a mini war, with all the terribleness of what war entails on both sides. Certainly, Mormons don't deserve what happened at Hahn's Mill, but the locals also didn't deserve the deaths on their side of the raids that also burned houses and disrupted lives.
Here's the thing. Complexity and messiness are elements of Mormon history that have to be emphasized. I mean, I'm working on a biography of historian Juanita Brooks, and in it, I talk about a letter that she has written to her by her very loyal sister, Charity. Charity's pissed and doesn't understand why Juanita is talking about a history of the Mountain Meadows Massacre that involved their grandfather. And the massacre actually captured some of the themes we're talking about in Missouri, this conflict and war and mob mentality. So Charity can't understand why Juanita just doesn't let this event rest. This is another legacy Mormons have to contend with. For many, any attempt to explore complexity is triggering. They see it as an indictment. But by talking of Mormon examples where the traditional Mormon narrative is too simplistic, it feels to many like all historians do is emphasize the negative. While discussions like we're trying to present today can come off that way, the reality is that history is complex and messy, and shiny, neat history is a problem. Things just don't play out that way, especially in war. There are two sides to every story. Again, we're certainly not free of that bias, but we do want to depict things fairly. Yes, we know, lots of soapboxes today.
Now, remember as Newman taught us, when you control the mail, you control information. Sometimes that information sucks, though. In the middle of all this chaos, bad intel was rampant. Missouri Governor Lilburn Boggs, I'll pause here for the booing and hissing, he really is Mormonism's silent film villain. He'd received a report that the Mormon militia had gone nuts at the Crooked River skirmish and had taken out most of the local militia unit, which is just unequivocally wrong. The result, though? One of the most infamous moments in all of Mormon history. Boggs wrote out an executive order and sent it to General John Clark. So based on this erroneous report, the governor informed Clark that it, quote, entirely changes the face of things and places the Mormons in the attitude of an open and avowed defiance of the laws and of having made war upon the people of this state. Your orders are, therefore, to hasten your operation with all possible speed. The Mormons must be treated as enemies and must be exterminated or driven from the state if necessary for the public peace. Within a week, troops occupy Far West, arrest Joseph Smith and other Mormon leaders. The so-called Mormon War had come to an end.
This was the first truly low point of Mormon history. Joseph Smith and others were in state custody. The settlement of Far West was occupied, and the future was very uncertain. It's at this point that we're going to conclude the first season of Sunstone History Podcast. We've covered just 8 years, but it seems like so much longer. Mormonism really knew how to pack the action in, but honestly, it was just getting started. When we return for next episode, starting the beginning of season 2, we're going to talk about perhaps the most colorful period in all of Mormon history, Nauvoo. So if you've enjoyed this, tune in for next episode where we start the Nauvoo period for season 2.
I know, this is a tough moment. Let's all pull it together because it's time for the last Books of Mormon's report. It's very sad. Today, spotlight is on Fire and Sword, A History of the Latter-day Saints in Northern Missouri, 1836 to 1839, published by Greg Coford Books. This is probably the most unique book we've talked about so far. It started life as actually a dissertation written by historian Leland Gentry in 1965. 50 years later, Todd Compton, who you probably best know as the author of In Sacred Loneliness, was asked to update Gentry's work. The discussion of these complicated topics, Danites, violent rhetoric toward dissenters, Mormon raids, is careful but also still candid. Happy reading, and see you in season two.
Offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
But only the song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.